This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
An Act of Uniformity, 1549, same year as the prayer book, giving an order of and giving order to all the variety of services. So basically this was prescribing penalties for not using the service book. So, I mean, some people took this as a rather oppressive act, even though a lot of people were, you know, excited about the new Protestant movement here. If you, when the Act of Uniformity was passed, if you were a priest and you refused to use the New Book of Common Prayer, you got 6 months in jail and lost 1 year's salary. So, you know, everyone's kind of enforcing their will here. Some priests did refuse to follow it. And the imposition of the prayer book plus some new taxes brought about armed rebellion. So no matter which direction one of the kings goes, somebody doesn't like it. And it seems like under each one of the kings and queens of the Reformation era, there's going to be an armed conflict over these things. During this time, under Edward VI, was known as Clet's Rebellion. The Earl of Warwick, or of Northumberland, put it down. This is where Somerset, who had been the protector, was perceived as a friend of these rebels, and so the council of advisors, the Edward VI, turned against him, and Somerset is executed. So now the Earl of Warwick becomes the chief counselor now to the king, and he is going to proceed, though, with the Protestant reform. By 1552, a second prayer book. One of the shifts from 49 to 52 in terms of the prayer book is making the sermon more central. That's a Protestant idea, isn't it? Rather than the Eucharistic service or liturgy being the high point of the service, really the sermon, and wanting to make that very prominent in the service of worship. In 1553, the 42 Articles. This is the precursor of the 39 Articles, which we think of when we think of the theology of the Church of England. But initially, 42 Articles. It's going to be modified in the next 2 years, be incorporated as the 39 Articles under Queen Elizabeth. But now the 42 Articles, condemning such things as purgatory, indulgences, images, relics, prayers to the saints, the Mass, the papacy. So some very specific doctrines are both negated and some affirmed. Justification by faith alone and predestination. So you see the Calvinistic influence. But you can look over the 39 Articles. Fascinating document. If you look in some historical texts, you can see copies of the 42 Articles also. But a more definitive statement of faith. There was a commission of 32 that penned this statement of faith, half clergy, half layman. It was composed, though, primarily by Cranmer. His mark upon it is very clear. And guess what he used as the primary basis of it? The Augsburg Confession of 1530. So the statement of faith. So you can you sense Melanchthon's ongoing influence in the English church. Remember, Melanchthon was the author of the Augsburg Confession. Luther concurred with it, although he's not the author. In terms of the nature of Christ's presence, again, a more Protestant understanding there in the 42 Articles and against the transubstantiation, and clearly not holding to that. Well, the teenager Edwards, the king, his health is failing. He contracts tuberculosis. And Northumberland, wanting to keep his position as basically the power behind the throne, and came up with a scheme And this was a very dangerous scheme, but wanting to keep a Protestant on the throne, there was a lot of concern about, all right, when Edward VI dies, who's going to be the next? Well, in this case, it was going to have to be queen. Who's going to be the queen? And is it going to be Mary Tudor? And so they were concerned about that and what that would mean for rolling back the progress that they felt they had made. So basically what Northumberland does, they come up with a scheme, and he had his son marry Lady Jane Grey, who's a 16-year-old young lady from an old Protestant family. She was the grandniece of Henry VIII, and it felt like they could legitimately perhaps claim the throne, although popularly in England, there was a sense that Mary was the legitimate king. So Lady Jane Grey was the Queen of England for all of 9 days. And this brave, you can read Fox's Book of Martyrs to read about her demise, as she had the Psalms read as she was executed and killed for participating in this this scheme. Cranmer had concurred with this, and so he's eventually going to lose his life because of this attempt to keep a Protestant on the throne also. Well, Mary Tudor, meanwhile, had kind of been in remote areas and in different ways, had made vows to concur with Henry VIII and although Edward VI reforms, but many people felt like she was the legitimate queen, and as historians have pointed out, probably one of the, you never know how one little turn in history, the difference it makes. You know, Lady Jane Grey probably could have been the Queen of England, except for one thing, they did not act quick enough to grab Mary Tudor and imprison her. And she got popular support, comes into London, and it's all over. And she is the new Queen of England, and all of a sudden there's going to be a forceful movement to return England and its church to its Catholic, Roman Catholic heritage. So Lady Jane Grey, her father beheaded, as was her husband, Northumberland's son. So Mary now is going to become the queen. And you'll notice she also had a very short reign, just like her half-brother, Edward. Now, a number of things we could say about Mary Tudor. She had maintained her Catholic convictions, even though she had outwardly, kind of conformed to the Church of England. In many ways, she considered herself Spanish. Remember, her mother was Catherine of Aragon, Spanish queen of England. And so when she becomes queen, initially recognized the reality, the fact that many of her subjects now are very Protestant, she privately practiced her Catholicism in her chapel. And you can see evidence of that in her quarters, where she had a little chapel where a mass could be said by her private priest. And Mary Tudor is going to push back against some of the reforms. And just as Edward VI had tried to undo some of what Henry VIII had done, now Mary is going to try to undo what Edward had tried to accomplish. And you'll notice the category there for Mary Tudor, militant Catholicism. I mean, she was really set against the Protestants. Well, as you can imagine, this stirred up a lot of trouble for the Protestants, and all these wonderful Protestant scholars, Knox, Bucer, and all these folks that had made their way into England, now have to flee, because to hang around means that you're probably going to be arrested and very well could be executed. So John Knox flees back to the continent, and we'll pick up with his story a little bit later and see how this is a period where he is going to have contact with John Calvin in Geneva, which will form a lot of his ideas both doctrinally and ecclesiastically. So Mary now comes to the throne, and she hangs up her forbidden crucifix in her little chamber there, and practicing her faith. And she's now going to set about getting rid of all of Edward's officials. So now you've got all these Protestant bishops who are now going to be replaced by Catholic bishops. She restores the Latin Mass. Remember the Book of Common Prayer? The liturgy had been required by law to be in English. She's going to go back and push for the Latin Mass as a part of the liturgy again. But there was some resistance in Parliament to some of what she wanted to do. But Mary is going to have her way in many ways as these bishops are replaced. And Stephen Gardiner becomes a Lord Chancellor. This advisor, who's very close to Mary, is going to perpetrate a lot of the heresy hunting. There are these Protestant leaders. Cranmer is put in prison. So are Latimer and Ridley. And let me tell you about these two men, because I'm going to say more about their stories. Hugh Latimer. He was a famous preacher, Protestant preacher in England. And he had been a student at Cambridge University, and there he eventually had encountered the Protestant gospel and become converted. His conversion's rather intriguing in terms of a Protestant kind of tricked him. Here he was a leader there, a teacher at Cambridge, and a Protestant came to him for confession one time. And he was so overwhelmed by the account of this Protestant, of how the scriptures were a comfort to him, that he ended up converting to Protestantism and became one of the great Protestant preachers in all of England. He became very close to Edward VI, preaching throughout the realm, and after his conversion, targeting Catholicism, and also preached about social justice. Henry had made him an advisor, and he boldly once even preached before Henry VIII and had chastised the king for using violence to impose religion on people. So he's a pretty bold dude. But he publicly opposed the king's 6 articles, and he had actually been made a bishop, and he resigned that position. So he was one of the Protestants who just was not willing to live under this. Well, Henry dies, and when Edward VI becomes king, he flourished as a leading preacher of Protestantism. But then when Mary, because he was so prominent and well-known, when Mary comes to the throne, she throws Latimer in the tower, and eventually he's going to be moved to Oxford to stand trial. Well, another individual who's thrown in prison at the same time with Cranmer and Latimer was Bishop Ridley. Now, he was the Bishop of London, so this is a very prominent position here in the king's capital, if you would, and chief city. He also had a scholarly career at Cambridge. He had served as a chaplain to Cranmer. They were very close. He had been influential in helping Cranmer move away from transubstantiation, and it had some real input on the Book of Common Prayer. One of the things he had done at the Bishop of London, Ridley had the stone altars replaced by wooden tables for serving communion. And but he had unwisely supported the claim of Lady Jane Grey there in London. And so when things became known, and Mary, just like with Cranmer, because of this, what was considered treason, he was thrown in jail. Well, Latimer, Ridley, and Cranmer were all taken to Oxford, where their heretical opinions were tried. So not only the treason, but also for their Protestant ideas, they were persecuted. Well, these men are jailed. Many flee to the continent. She's undoing Edward's reforms. But there was some resistance in Parliament to her wanting to turn back all of the Protestant reforms. So that was an encouraging thing. She had wanted to disinherit Elizabeth, which Parliament would not allow. She wanted to restore the harsh laws against the Lollards, which Parliament did not allow. She wanted to reinstate the 6 articles. Parliament said no. And they would not reestablish the monastery. So you can see that Parliament was willing to stand up to the queen and not concur in some of the things that she wanted to do. It gives you an idea of the power of Parliament at this time. So as she's beginning to make her move against Protestantism, she didn't get her will in everything. But then she made a decision which obviously in Protestant minds was very much perceived as a negative move. She marries Philip II of Spain. This very prominent Roman Catholic sovereign. So, but they were not able to have children. And so this was something that left her in disfavor among the English populace who wanted to see a royal child born to the couple. But that did not take place. Remember I said that she considered herself Spanish, though, and wanted to maintain her Catholic theology. Well, she passed an injunction against married clergy, and around 2,000 ministers lose their livings as a result of this. So she's really going after the Protestants. Well, Philip II eventually is going to sail back to Spain. They were not able to have any children, but Mary will begin the bloody persecutions in January of 1555. Cardinal Reginald Pole, who's the official legate, just to show you how far things went, he brought, as a papal legate, he came from Italy, and he brought official papers from the papacy which was going to absolve England for its disobedience. That's the extreme to which Mary was going, and in which the papacy wanted to see now England come back under her umbrella. Well, Cardinal Pole, who by the way is going to be an important person at the Council of Trent, we'll talk about Cardinal Pole later. He began he was appointed Archbishop of Canterbury. He commissions bishops to start trying heretics, and a number of them would face their demise in. Latimer, this a Protestant preacher, and also Ridley will end up facing charges as heretics. Let me just read to you as they were brought there to Oxford to stand trial. Here are the accusations that were brought against them in the official documents. We do object to thee, Nicholas Ridley, and to thee, Hugh Latimer, jointly and severally. First, Ridley, in this High University of Oxford in the year 1554, you have affirmed and openly defended, maintained, in many other times and places beside that true and natural body of Christ, after the consecration of the priest, is not really present in the sacrament of the altar. That thou hast publicly affirmed and defended that in the sacrament of the altar remains still the substance of bread and wine. That thou hast openly affirmed and obstinately maintained that in the Mass there is no propitiatory sacrifice for the living and the dead. So it became a trial, in essence, over transubstantiation in the Mass, is what they turned it into, that these men held a Protestant views which were unacceptable. So Latimer and Ridley stand trial, giving their arguments there together. Latimer says to Ridley, "Be of good heart, brother, for God will either assuage the fury of the flame or else strengthen us to abide in it," as the two of them are condemned. Here, then, you've got the words of Ridley. Is they're brought up to the flames, and there was a ditch where they were brought there in Oxford, and Ridley prayed, and I'm reading from Fox's Book of Martyrs. Fox, John Fox, had become convinced of Protestantism, and he is one of the Protestants that fled to the continent, and basically his Book of Martyrs is a monument. In fact, it's called the Acts and Monuments of the time of persecution under Mary Tudor. But he records Ridley's prayer, "O Heavenly Father, I give unto thee most hearty thanks that thou hast called me to be a professor of thee, even unto death. I beseech thee, Lord God, have mercy on this realm of England and deliver it from all her enemies." So the two men are bound at the stake. And there you've got the acts and monuments of the latter and perilous days of the church. Fox's Book of Martyrs. But the two of them are bound there together. Dr. Ridley's brother brought to him a bag of gunpowder and tied it around his neck. This is what they would do. And he asked, well, is there some for my brother also? He says, yes. So he goes and ties the gunpowder around Latimer's neck also. Well, they brought the lighted faggot and laid it at Dr. Ridley's feet, upon which Mr. Latimer said, and these are famous words, "Be of good comfort, Mr. Ridley, and play the man. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out." And there both of them suffered in the flames, and particularly Ridley. It was a horrible sight, witnessed by many. And Ridley died very slowly, and it was horrific. And the people witnessed that, and it became a something emblazoned upon the minds of all Protestants in England, and immortalized in Fox's Book of Martyrs. And if you go to Oxford today, you find the famous Martyrs Monument to Latimer and Ridley. Very prominent monument there on the campus of Oxford. "Be of good comfort, Mr. Ridley, and play the man. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out." And there were eyewitness accounts that Fox used to write his account of this. Here's the actual site. It's not a ditch now, but where Ridley and Latimer were burned at the stake. Well, Thomas Cranmer, I told you he had also been captured by the Queen. He is brought to great St. Mary's on the campus there at Oxford. And Cranmer, out of fear, first recanted and took back his views on the Lord's Supper. They also made his trial about that. And if you go into St. Mary's, where I was last week, you can see the actual column. This is from Fox's Book of Martyrs. They included prints in the book. You see the little stage that they made for Cranmer, and you can still see the column where that little stage was. And Cranmer is up there, and he had publicly signed with his hand a recantation. But then when it came to the final hour, Mary decided, "I don't care if he recants or not, I'm still going to burn him at the stake as an example." Cranmer got up, and at the last minute, he got up and he said, "I recant my recantations." And the church officials were so angry, they ripped him down off that little stage and took him right to the same ditch where Latimer and Ridley had died. And as Cranmer died, he spoke out to the crowd and he said, "As the flames start, I'm going to hold in the fire my hand, the hand that I signed the recantations." And eyewitnesses say that he really did that. And he held his hand in the flames and let the fires consume his hand, just to show his repentance for ever signing the views that he recanted. And he told, at his trial, he said, "These are my real views." So Cranmer also, his account in Fox's Book of Martyrs. And while their accounts are obviously the more famous ones, Latimer, Ridley, and Cranmer, because of Fox telling in detail the story from eyewitnesses about what happened as these three men were brutally killed by Mary Tudor and under her command. But many others died. Well, eventually, Mary Tudor herself is going to perish. She loses heart, loses the will to live. It's during the latter years of her reign that England loses Calais in northern France. It's kind of the last area where England had a beachhead within France. And this was really a blow to English pride. And she realizes that she's not going to be able to do all that she wills in England. Well, here is just a map showing the Marian persecution. The estimates are that around 300 people, approximately, were burned at the stake during Mary Tudor's persecution of the Protestants. And Reginald Pole, within 12 hours of Mary dying, he dies in his sleep. So both of these are perpetrators of these horrendous acts perish. Well, when Mary dies, Queen Elizabeth is going to ascend to the throne. She is 25 years old. Yes, Norman?
Quick question. Yeah. I mean, obviously, Mary has this probably well-deserved reputation for being Bloody Mary, but persecuted. But I mean, it seems, I mean, was she really that much worse than any other ruler of her time?
I think that's, you know, that's a legitimate, you know, question to ask. I think it was really the influence of Reginald Pole, who had come from the Pope, who she appointed the Archbishop of Canterbury, who forced the bishops now to begin these trials. So Mary had that, you know, the that Catholic influence. But there's no question, though, that she gave her approval to this in ways that was very severe. You know, I don't know the number of people that, you know, Henry VIII died. There are, you know, a handful of prominent ones, but under Mary, it was incredibly violent. And you know, Edward VI had punished priests that had not submitted to the Book of Common Prayer, but he wasn't running around killing people.
Was this during the same time as the Spanish Inquisition in Spain as well?
Well, the Spanish Inquisition actually goes back to the 15th century. It started before the Reformation, but I would say there were reverberations of the Spanish Inquisition that was still going on. Because what happened in the Netherlands, for example, is considered the Spanish opposition to Protestants there is kind of considered a part of the greater Spanish Inquisition. That's a great question. To remember, she was a Spaniard. Remember, married to Philip II. And they had pretty much run most of the Protestants out of Spain. Spain maintains strong Roman Catholic country throughout the Reformation era. It really doesn't even waver. And so that is very important. And so I think that's a good observation. You wonder what the influence, even though he had gone back to Spain eventually, that her own husband, the King of Spain, had in urging her, well, you know, we did it in Spain, you can do it here. But Reginald Pole was the one who got the bishops to do it. But it was a horrific thing, and because of the horror of a lot of this, it turned a lot of popular sentiment back toward the Protestant movement again. But we're seeing how violent this had all become. Well, Mary, after she passes away, and Elizabeth comes to the throne. Now you just think about what Elizabeth had on her hands now. Now she's 25 years old, young woman. And, you know, Mary had even incarcerated her for a while. And at one point, remember, I'd said tried to get Parliament to remove Elizabeth from the line of succession, but they would not agree to do that. And it was questionable if Mary was going to even put Elizabeth to death at one point. Elizabeth was put in the Tower of London. But I tell you, Elizabeth, she was a strong-willed woman. When they brought her to the Tower of London, she refused to go in. She said, I'm not going in until I get that room up there. She wanted a good view. She wanted to have her own cook. And she said, I'm not going in. I think if people would have arrested me, and particularly taken me to the Tower, I'd have been glad to go anywhere. Well, I don't want to upset these people. But Elizabeth, though, a part of the, the genuine brilliance that she had was she recognized that in all the carnage and the turmoil that my realm is in, I got to patch this thing back up together. And so what Elizabeth did, now remember, her half-brother and half-sister had each had six-year reigns, which says, you know, the king and queen of England don't last very long. This is a dangerous position to be in. That woman was the queen of England for 45 years. That is incredible in the 16th century. I mean, it really is. But part of her brilliance was she was committed to, I've got to find a middle way. And so she believed that her brother, half-brother Edward, was on the right track to demand uniformity, but a more along Protestant lines. And so she is going to go back and she is going to push for an enforced Episcopalianism and really trying to have capture part of that vision her father had had for a distinctive English church, but of a more Protestant ilk. But, you know, as she did this famous Via Media, the middle way, trying to steer between the extremes, feeling pressure. Now, John Knox, known as one who never mixed his words, said this about Queen Elizabeth: she is neither a good Protestant nor a resolute papist. And that kind of captured it. She's neither one. And I think many people tried to figure out what Elizabeth really was about. But she did have a Protestant council which advised her. She desired this Anglican establishment and wanted to keep both Catholics and radical Protestants under control. She had a good Archbishop of Canterbury in Matthew Parker, who had been her mother's chaplain and even her tutor as a young girl. Matthew Parker was a disciple of Martin Bucer. So it gives you an idea of the strong Protestant background that he had. Well, they begin now to fill many of the bishoprics. You know, Mary brought her bishops in. Now they get rid of them. And, you know, the bishops just are pawns. Depending on who the king is, it depends, on who's going to be bishop and what his theological views will be, or at least what he agreed to advocate in that position. Well, many of the bishoprics were filled with exiles, which came back now into England and brought the Reformed theology with them. Well, the Elizabethan settlement, as we call it, now came into being. Now, you notice Elizabeth now as we follow along in the chart, along the line with now Henry Reformed Catholicism and a more advanced Protestant, now back to Catholicism, and now what we might officially call Episcopalianism. And I think because of her reign and the ability to keep her realm together during this time, that for all practical purposes, the Church of England as we now know it becomes established under Elizabeth. Even though the first steps were initiated under Henry VIII, it's really the Queen Elizabeth. And in the 1559 Act of Supremacy, you'll notice that down here, officially Roman Catholic Church is going to have no jurisdiction ever in England again. Because remember, Mary had tried to bring back some Roman jurisdiction. And Reginald Pole had tried to move England back under that umbrella. But Elizabeth says absolutely not. And in the Act of Supremacy of 1559, that pretty much closes the door forever on Roman Catholicism in England in terms of being the religion of the crown. Although we'll find in the 17th century there are a few of the English kings who are going to privately practice Catholicism, and even though they have no option but to outwardly tolerate Protestants and outwardly be good Episcopalians, in practice some of them did hold more Catholic sentiments. So the Anglican establishment, the new bishops, and a new Act of Uniformity, 1559, going back to the Edwardsian perspective, and now reintroduces the second prayer book of Edward. And it became law now to deny the supremacy of the crown over the church or to refuse an oath of loyalty resulted in immediate deprivation of office. So all the priests and bishops have to swear loyalty to Queen Elizabeth. And the clergy who refused to comply were gradually replaced. But notice what she's doing. I mean, she wasn't tolerating a lot of diversity of views, and she mandated this, but she wasn't running around killing people. And you basically, if you would, your priesthood, you'd lose your livelihood and your office. And bishops, they were just put out of the church. Basically, it's not saying Elizabeth, you know, hesitated to be strong when she needed to be, but she had learned by watching what had happened under Mary that that's not a good way to have strong sentiment among your people. So Elizabeth begins that. Now, we're going to come back and talk about Elizabeth a little bit more after we look at the Reformation in Scotland. So this is by no means the last chapter on looking at Elizabeth. But after we look into Trent, we'll visit the whole Elizabethan Puritan movement, which is so important for us as Protestants in America. And so we'll come back to Elizabeth at that time. But before I leave this little segment and before we go to our small groups, let me just say a little bit about the Reformation in Ireland. Next week we'll pick up and talk about the Reformation in Scotland. Okay, because we're really talking about England proper more at this time. We'll talk about the relationship of England and Scotland and Knox's important influence. But let's see what happened in Ireland. Was there Reformation in Ireland? Well, the Irish common people essentially saw this Reformation movement that they heard about so much taking place in England or on the Big Island. As a foreign movement. You know, the Irish had a distinctive ethnic identity, and they associated Reformation ideas with the English and with colonists, and they were therefore more inclined to maintain their Catholicism. Well, Henry VIII had been the first English king to attempt control of Ireland, at least in the Reformation era. Ireland was ruled by tribal chieftains in different provinces, and there was pressure certainly to respect the King of England, but Anglicanism as a whole was foreign to the Irish. Now, royal order to impose Anglicanism didn't come until the time of Edward VI. So it was in Edward's Act of Uniformity that he is pushing forward in England, also related to Ireland. And Cranmer actually had put a Protestant in St. Patrick's chair, which was the highest position in Ireland, him being the patron saint of the Irish. And so there were attempts to bring Ireland into the fold, so to speak. Well, when Mary became queen, Mary Tudor, she replaced the Protestant bishops with Catholics during her reign. So Ireland's a part of the flip-flop going on with the kings and queens of England, so she gets Catholic bishops again. And she actually, under Mary, they established military colonies in Ireland, but she was not able to restore the monastic lands. Now that's important because monasticism had always been important in Ireland. In fact, there had been a unique expression of monasticism. We call it Celtic monasticism. By the time the Anglo-Saxons invade England in the 6th, 7th century, the Celts basically are resigned to Wales and Ireland. And Celtic Christianity had been very strong, but very closely tied later on to the Roman Church, but had been rather independent in the early years. That's a story for Church History 1. But anyway, a little background there. Well, Elizabeth, during her reign, a long reign of 45 years, would conquer Ireland and seal, though ironically, its Catholic future. There were four campaigns that she had to fight against the chieftains of Ireland. The chief seat of resistance was in Ulster, in Northern Ireland. It took most of her reign to accomplish this. And really the only English area in Ireland is what we call the Pale. Most of you probably heard that expression of being within the Pale. This was the English area of Ireland. It was known as the Pale. And really the rest of Ireland, for all practical purposes, is going to remain Roman Catholic. Now, there are going to be pockets of Protestants. For example, we'll talk about later the Protestant colonies that are planted in Northern Ireland, beginning toward the end of Elizabeth's reign and James I's reign, and Irish Presbyterian will be established here, and this is where the famous Scots-Irish will immigrate to America from over here. But during Elizabeth's time, it's really within the Pale that the English Church had influence there in the English sphere in Ireland. The rest of it was very resistant. Well, Elizabeth really didn't try to accept uniformity except in the Pale and some of the larger towns. Again, one of the things you have to respect about Elizabeth, she was a realist. She was a realist. She knew that even though she conquered them militarily, it's just not going to happen to make Ireland all conform to the Book of Common Prayer. So she really didn't even do that. And so she couldn't enforce uniformity there. Well, by the year 1603, when Elizabeth died, the conquest of Ireland was complete. But there was not really a missionary movement of Protestants in Ireland at this point. So the Reformation in Ireland had very shallow roots. And as G.R. Elton has said, at the beginning of Elizabeth's reign, Ireland was virtually ungoverned and heathen. By the end, it was firmly under English control and Roman Catholic. And that's kind of the part of the story of how little, for all practical purposes, the Reformation touched Ireland. Again, there would be, during colonization later, there would be pockets of Protestants in Northern Ireland, but primarily it will remain Roman Catholic.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.